This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Sarah Tyson, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Adam Toon, associate professor of philosophy at the University of Exeter. His new book, Mind as Metaphor, is just out from Oxford University Press. Folk psychology, on a standard reading, is the way we attribute contentful mental states to others in order to explain and predict their behavior. For example, saying that John thinks the plant needs water as an inner mental state that explains why he is looking for the watering can. In his new book, Toon argues that this view is incorrect. We do not have mental representations. Instead, while our concept of mind is of an inner world, this inner world is a fiction. What we are really doing is picking out complex patterns of behavior and projecting this inward. Intentionality, meanwhile, resides in public language, not in the mind. Toon also distinguishes his view from Ryle's and Dennett's and argues that while the ascriptions should not be taken literally, their purpose is serious and our practice of ascribing them is indispensable. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Adam Toon. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This is a great, very fun book, actually, to read. Well-written, but also very intriguing. And, you know, I can't say I was completely persuaded by Mind as Metaphor, but I'm kind of willing to be persuaded. And I think there's a lot of interesting points that you make during the course of the book.
Thank you.
So before we get into the details of the book, tell us a bit about yourself. You're now at Exeter. So how did you get into philosophy and how did you come to write this book?
Yeah, thank you. If I think back to school, I was sort of perhaps one of those kids who was interested in pretty much everything across the humanities and sciences. But in the UK, anyway, you're asked to sort of specialize, pick what, you know, three or four subjects fairly young, about 15, 16. So I ended up doing the maths and sciences, and I was lucky enough to get a place at university in Cambridge to do maths and physics, and I had a great time. But I think as I look back on it, I think I could sort of hear friends in the college bar, you know, having sort of big debates about politics or history or big ideas, big books, and so on, and started to feel it a little bit jealous. I was missing out on something there, as I saw this was 2 years into my degree, so I saw the end of my time looming. And I suppose also I got I'm slightly depressed at the, certainly not the attitude of any of my teachers and lecturers there, but the slightly dogmatic attitude you sometimes get around the sciences, which can sort of make you feel as if,
yeah,
you know, everything's kind of been found out, and other ways of finding out about the world or thinking about it in the past or in religion or what have you are just sort of obviously hopelessly irrational or what have you. So I think I just had an urge to sort of broaden out a little bit. So I was very lucky that it's possible at where I was studying to change subjects fairly late on. So I was asked to Funnily enough, given the subject of this book, I was asked to go and write an essay on Descartes. So I sort of, you know, went back to my, it was a gas fire heated room, not a stove heated room, and started writing an essay on Descartes. And I was allowed to change to study history and philosophy of science as a dedicated department, as many of you.
Yes.
Cambridge. And it was just a wonderful experience. You know, I found myself in that final year of the degree learning about everything from sort of, you know, ancient astronomy to Renaissance magic traditions and science in the Cold War or what have you. And I just booked, but like I sort of found a home intellectually. I suppose the kind of the lovely combination for me was on the one hand, I was lucky enough to go to Peter Lipton's lectures that he gave on causation and laws of nature and so on. And there was something just really wonderful about seeing those concepts that, you know, are of course used routinely all the time in the sciences, like causation or laws of nature, but seeing them, as it were, sort of fall apart or start to look a lot more complicated than they'd seemed. But at the same time, to have this lovely sense that you could contribute, I mean, it's partly because Peter was just such a wonderful teacher, but you felt as if these concepts were difficult, but nevertheless, that in this room together, just by trying to think clearly, by trying to use our imagination to come up with counterexamples, you know, what if people threw two pebbles at the milk bottle at the same time? How would we say one had caused it to break or what have you? That you felt as if that you were being shown that certain things were difficult, were, you know, taken for granted in a way that perhaps they shouldn't, but at the same time, given these tools to make progress in thinking about them and taming them, which was, and of course, you know, in the sciences that it might take you an awfully long time and a lot of money to get to that point where you felt like you could make that kind of progress. And so there was something very exciting about feeling as if you could start to do that in philosophy, just with a few of you in a room having a conversation. And I think the other thing that was really wonderful about it was that alongside that kind of analytic philosophy of science, there was also this sense of the sort of wonderful sweep of the history of science that placed it in its material and social context. So, you know, thinking about whether or not the experimental method, you know, was something that was in its current form relatively recent. Did it have something to do with the particular social and political circumstances of the 17th century in England or what have you? Those were just very powerful and interesting ideas to engage with. And I think in a way, as I reflect on it now, it's really bringing those two strands of interest together that sort of motivates this book, really, trying to bring together, you know, on the one hand, all of the questions that have traditionally interested philosophers and in our tradition epistemology in particular about reasoning and the relationship of mind to world and so on, with hopefully a sense of just the messy complexity of the material and social context in which reasoning and inquiry happens. And I think, you know, there's a temptation, I mean, I include myself in this, of to listen to all those histories about that complexity, about the, you know, the institutions that need setting up, or the material culture of the sciences and so on, but to sort of think, yeah, but we're interested in what goes on in here. And I'm sort of, you know, tapping my forehead as I say that, you know, that we're sort of, that's all important, but we're interested in reasoning or concepts or knowledge and all the sorts of things that philosophers often concern themselves with. And I suppose, broadly speaking, what I was interested in doing in the book was trying to think about a conception of mind that can do justice to that material and social culture, to say, well, this is what reasoning is, this is what it looks like. It's not, as it were, just something that happens in here, as it were, touching my forehead again, but it's something that happens in the world, that changes over time and so on.
Hey, well, you've touched on a number of, you know, issues that we will return to. I mean, you do have a background in, you know, thinking about scientific modeling as well as material culture, as you mentioned. But this is, you know, mind as metaphor. So maybe just to start us off, give us a, you know, very brief, you know, we'll get into details, but a little, you know, brief synopsis of what the view is.
Yeah, I suppose the view starts from this thought that we often think about the mind as an inner world, that, you know, when you look in someone's eyes, as it were, you can imagine that somewhere in there, there's an inner world that houses their beliefs, their desires, their hopes, their fears, and so on. And that's what the mind is. It's something that we can hopefully get some indication about in the case of other people by observing their behavior, but it's not something that's directly available to us. And it's something that lies inside and that is the home of their thoughts, their mental states, perhaps their feelings as well. And I suppose what I wanted to do is to say that view of the inner world, particularly as thoughts, as kind of inner representations of the world, I want to say that that's a useful fiction. In other words, people don't really have those inner worlds, but it's very useful. In fact, it's indispensable for us, at least in our culture, to think about them as if they had those inner worlds that housed their beliefs and desires and so on. And the reason for using the term metaphor is to say, I think that the concept of mind that we have is a metaphorical projection of the outer world, of material culture, of spoken and written language and pictures and so on. I think it's a metaphorical projection of that outer world of material culture inside to create an imagined inner world of inner sentences, inner pictures, and so on that capture people's their thoughts, their beliefs, their intentions, their desires. And as I say, I think we can't do without that fiction, but I do think it is a fiction.
Okay, so good. So one of the things that, you know, when I first, you know, was when I was first reading through was, how restricted is this, right? I mean, it's you know, as I went through, is the idea of mental fictionalism seems to be restricted, right? I mean, it's you know, I think at one point you sort of set aside emotions and you know, more complicated sorts of states, but that the main target here is what's often called folk psychology, or at least the traditional sense of folk psychology, because people have greatly expanded what folk psychology involves. But it's the idea, it's, you know, folk psychology is the ascription of propositional attitudes, you know, sentences, and that these sentences describe the content of people's mental states. And in a, you know, classical, you know, computational model, there's a language of thought, and there are these sentences, and they're captured in our public language. But the main thrust is that thoughts are these, you know, sort of sentences in our heads, and that's specifically, I think, what you're targeting here. That idea is that correct?
Yes, I think that's correct. Yeah, I suppose that view that sometimes known as computationalism view is one of the most recent manifestations of a view, a broader view of representationalism, as it's often called. The, you know, the thought that, as you say, propositional attitudes in particular, or thoughts, or inner representations, that is often traced back to the early modern period. But absolutely, as you say, and it's most recent form, especially since, of course, the founding of cognitive sciences in the 60s, it takes the particular form that you mentioned that draws on computationalism, and of course that view has all sorts of different varieties as well.
So, the idea is that we have thoughts, but they're just not propositional attitudes. Would that be right?
I'm not sure I'd put it like quite like that, but let me try to. So I think that if the question is simply, do we have thoughts, or do we, let's put it quite straightforwardly or dogmatically, do we have minds? I think what I'd say is, well, if by mind you mean an inner world of states with content, so states that represent the world outside and are caused by the world when in perception, for instance, and cause us to behave in certain ways, then I think, no, we don't have minds in that sense. So we don't have inner sentences that are language of thought or inner pictures and on a earlier Lockean view or what have you. Nevertheless, there's a sense in which we do have minds, which is to say we do have genuine patterns in our behavior that are picked out by the metaphor. So roughly speaking, I think when we talk about people's beliefs and desires, we're saying very roughly they behave as if they were guided by an inner representation with this content. The representation doesn't exist, but what we say is true or false depending on the way that person behaves, and those patterns in their behavior do exist. So in a sense, asking do people have minds is, to use a parallel that I mentioned in the book a few times, so it's a little bit like asking, are there angry clouds? The answer is, well, yes and no. There aren't clouds that really are angry or sad or what have you, but there are clouds that are perfectly appropriately picked out by that metaphor someday. And I think the same is true about people and minds. There are patterns in our behavior that are perfectly correctly picked out by using the metaphors that we use, even if the inner states are fictions.
Okay, so I'm trying to get a fix on what is, and is there, I mean, clearly we're conscious of something, and I can sit and, cogitate without behaving in any way. And the specificity of what's going on in my head will not be captured by my behavior or any pattern of behavior that I might express, unless it's, of course, writing a sentence. So, you're not an eliminativist. Does that? You're a fictionalist. I mean, so I'm trying to tease out what's the difference between an eliminativist and then the view that you are defending. And I mean, you mentioned, this sort of we're picking out genuine patterns in our behavior. There is a background here in terms of, Ryle's, screed against the, the Cartesian theater or the ghost in the machine. And then, of course, Dennett's, his pattern, real patterns thing. So how are you different from an eliminativist, and how are you different from Ryle and Dennett?
Okay, yeah. And I think we should perhaps have the feeling that I should also come back to conscious experience that you asked about, because you asked about the restriction, as it were. Am I just talking about thoughts as propositional attitudes? What about other aspects of mind as well? And I have the feeling that that's sort of behind some of the points where you're pushing me as well. But perhaps if I stick to thoughts as propositional attitudes and try to fill out the view a little bit, as you say, by comparing it to these other well-known positions, that would help. I think, the one way that I would put it is to say that what in the first instance, what fictionalism is opposed to is the idea that our ordinary talk about the mind, as you said, it's often called folk psychology, particularly focusing on attributing beliefs and desires. Fictionalism, I think, is opposed to the idea that that's giving a theory of our inner machinery in some way. Now, and that's a very common view about folk psychology, right? That it's an attempt to describe what's going on in our heads. And roughly speaking, at least the classical form of computationalism that you mentioned earlier accepts that idea and is fairly optimistic about folk psychology, right? That says, well, by and large, with some rounding error and so on, that theory of our inner worlds is true. It will turn out to be vindicated by future cognitive science. We'll find that we do have beliefs and desires as states, inner representational states that cause us to behave in certain ways. as I see it, that the eliminativist, with regard here to propositional attitudes, has the same starting point. Says, yeah, the way we ought to understand the folk is that they're kind of proto-scientific theorists about the inner world. They're just much more pessimistic. Right? That they think that that vision of the world that the folk have, the inner world that the folk have, will turn out to be wrong. Right? So that it will turn out that our future cognitive science shows that we don't have beliefs and desires, for instance, and other kinds of folk states. So as I see it, that representationalism and eliminativism have this common starting point, which is just to say folk psychology is a theory of the inner world. And that's what I want to reject. I want to say that the folk aren't in the business of theorizing about our inner machinery, our inner states, and so on. Now, as you say, then of course there are other views that would agree with me there, that would say, yeah, you're quite right that the folk aren't offering a theory of inner machinery, and behaviorism and instrumentalism are two well-known versions of that approach. And some of these approaches are often thought to not work for various reasons. So, you know, behaviorism is often thought to run into a lot of problems, for example. Now, I think, so if I focus on Ryle and Dennett, I think they're both, you know, they're both wonderful thinkers. They're both thinkers who can be hard to classify according to the sort of easy labels, right? So, you know, Ryle is often referred to as a behaviorist, but certainly a lot of the central claims of behaviorism, like that we can reduce talk about the mind, talk about behavior, just don't appear in the concept of mind, for example. But certainly, I mean, as I read him, the main difference between my own approach and Ryle's would be roughly this, that Ryle's view seems to be that Cartesianism, by which I mean this ghost in the machine idea, the idea of the mind as an inner world, whether material or non-material, is a kind of philosophical mistake. It's something that principally Descartes, but other philosophers, have imposed upon the folk, upon our ordinary language. And it's, in Ryle's terms, it's a category mistake. It's a kind of misreading of ordinary language. And it's not part and parcel of our ordinary folk psychology. The main difference that I want way in which I want to differ from that view is I want to say, no, that Cartesianism, this idea of mind as inner world, is part and parcel of ordinary language. That where Cartesianism goes wrong, or where representationalism, for instance, goes wrong, is it takes that metaphor too seriously. So the view of the mind as an inner world, I think, is present in ordinary language. But the key thing to do is not, on the one hand, take it too seriously and think we do have that inner world, and that's broadly speaking the mistake that Cartesianism makes. On the other hand, I think the other mistake is to overlook the fact that conception of mind as inner world is part and parcel of our concept of mind, right? And I think that's the mistake that behaviorism in its usual form, for instance, makes. It tries to do away with that notion of inner world while still doing justice to our concept of mind. And I don't think you can do that. So for example, you know, in Ryle, he has this, I love the concept of mind. It's one of my favorite books in philosophy. And of course, he gives us all of these extremely rich, broadly speaking, dispositional analyses of mental states. And so, to say that someone has a particular belief is to say some extraordinarily complex thing about different behaviors they might engage in. And I suppose that one way to put the key claim of fictionalism is it's true that our talk about the mind is, as it were, dependent on those patterns of behavior. Really, all it is a way of picking out those patterns of behavior. But I think we can only pick them out through this metaphor of mind as inner world. So I think one of the things that metaphors do for us is they enrich our language. They allow us to say things that we couldn't say before we created a certain metaphor. And so, for instance, if we think about, example I use in the book, imagine, you know, you say about someone that they believe that the number 73 bus goes to Oxford Street, London. And, you know, a dispositional analysis will say, well, we're saying that to pick out this complex disposition in their behavior. But if you think about all the different sorts of behavior that could be associated with having that belief, from, you know, pointing to a particular spot in the timetable, running after a big red object going down the road, you know, hopping off that big red object at a certain point and so on. It's very hard to see what ties, like, why would I language pick out all of those different forms of behavior in some way? And the fictionalist thought as well, we do it because they're all forms of behavior that they're all ways in which we behave as if we had an inner sentence, right, that had that that claim about the number 73 bus. Those are all ways in which someone who walked around with a little notebook with number 73 bus goes to Oxford Street would be expected to behave. And that it's that's why we pick out that complex pattern. It's because we're operating with this particular sort of metaphor. Perhaps to move on to Dennett, because I realize I'm this has been a long answer.
So before we get to the Dennett, I did want to sort of follow up on what you're saying about Ryle. So the talk of mine is, you know, picking out, in fact, these complex patterns of behavior, not inner states. But then I think you said something that this is the only way we can, in fact, refer to these patterns of behavior. Is that correct?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Why is that?
That's a good question. My grounds for saying it are that I suppose, roughly speaking, that folk psychology seems to be indispensable. It's extremely hard to imagine what a limitedism that told us to do away with it would amount to, and that behaviorism was an attempt to translate, talk about the mind, to, as it were, reduce it to talk about behavior, seems to have failed. And so, as I say, one way to try to understand that is to say that the metaphors, as I would see them, of the mind are sometimes called representationally essential. So in other words, they can't be given literal characters. So they add some expressive ability to our language.
I suppose. Let's get to dinner. I mean, I don't want to. There's all kinds of things that I could ask, but. So you had mentioned before real patterns, and that immediately will bring up thoughts of Dennett. How does your view compare to or relate to Dennett's view? Quasi-realism, I think, is his preferred term. I don't know if that's your term, but...
Yes, it's funny. In fact, Dave was kind enough to write a paper for a volume I recently edited on mental fictionism, and I think his title is "Am I a Fictionalist?" And the first line sort of says, "Well, yes and no." I kind of what I want to say as well. It's a label he's resisted various times. I think I'd say that in my view, that the kind of machinery that I want to bring to in terms of pretense and so on to try to understand fictionism or to cash it out, I think helps to make sense of some of the aspects of Dennett's view that people have found problematic. So one aspect, for instance, is that he said, well, beliefs and desires are real, and yet a Martian who didn't have access to the intentional stance but had a complete physics and so on would nevertheless miss certain patterns in the world, in behavior. And again, I'd want to say, well, think again about the parallel with a claim like, you know, the clouds over Exeter are angry today, which they're not quite. But, now, you know, again, it seems like, well, that claim, even though it involves metaphor, could pick out a genuine pattern in the weather over Exeter on a particular day. It can be true or false in virtue of the way the world is. And it might be something that was missed by some otherwise expert Martian meteorologists who didn't have access to our particular set of metaphors. So I suppose One thing I would want to say is that certain aspects of identity that people have thought difficult seem to start to make sense of to you. I mean, another worry that people have had, for instance, is that sometimes it talks about beliefs and desires as in an informational state, sometimes just patterns of behavior that says they have this kind of dual character. And again, that's exactly what we'd expect if talk about the mind were metaphorical, because it's a projection for one domain, which is about representations and patterns and information in our external representations. It's a projection of that to make sense of behavior. Having said all that,
So the angry cloud thing, is a bit confusing to me. I do understand it as a metaphor, but the claim that the clouds are angry or the cloud is angry is about the cloud, right? It's not like the cloud is not really going through something that makes us draw a metaphor to human anger. But you're saying that we're talking about an inner world, and the propositional attitudes, the content descriptions we give are metaphorical, but you're getting rid of the world, and that's the inner world, and replacing with something else, and that's not what's going on with the angry cloud.
Yes, I think so. The thought is that if in the metaphor of the maybe that that parallels with this particular example don't bear pushing too far, but the thought is that what we're doing is we're making sense of people's behavior when they don't say things out loud, write things down, and so on. We're making sense of their behavior then through this metaphor by looking at this parallel, as it were, with the things that people do when they do write things down. So, for instance, we talk about memory as if it were a little inner notebook that we have. What we're doing, we're saying, well, you can make sense of that person by talking about them as if they had a notebook to hand where they could write down useful information and then look it up later on, use it to guide their actions. And so, like the cloud, the behavior and the pattern that they're engaging in, I think, is perfectly real. But the little inner notebook isn't. The inner representation isn't. That would be one way to put it. Just to go back to Dennett, just to make clear perhaps something, just to be clear about what I think is quite a fundamental difference that perhaps we'll come on to later. I think a key, as I read him, a key difference between the view I want to try to put forward in Dennett's is that I do think that language introduces something quite different. In other words, I think that as I read Dennett, I think the intentional stance seems to be, as it were, a story about intentionality as a whole, whereas what I want to say is, well, in fact, it's what we're doing is projecting public intentionality, especially language, onto the mind. So the view does allow that there's something, as it were, fundamentally different that comes into being with social creatures like us who use language that's then metaphorically projected inside. And I think that's an important difference with that.
Okay. Right. But I guess like Dennett, maybe, I mean, for him, the intentional stance, you can use it for anything. It's just a matter of prediction and explanation. But
yes, I think.
And language itself adds something to that. So his view is very flattening in that sense, right? Anything, you can take the intentional stance towards anything, just as you can take, of course, the physical stance or the design stance. Your view also seems a bit flattening in the sense that maybe any creature, you know, I'm thinking of non-human animals. You know, we ascribe, you know, contents to them as well, but we don't think, you know, I don't know who's we here, but many people would agree, I think, that the sentences that we use to ascribe the contents to their thoughts are not really precise. I mean, we have a particular, you know, we know what the dog wants to go outside, you know, that sort of thing, or he wants to eat or something. But we don't, we'd be reluctant to say, yes, I've actually captured the exact content of my dog's thoughts or my cat's thoughts or whatever. And so in that sense, when I talk about what's going on in a person, a human's head, it's kind of the same, right? There's no difference there. As long as you've got sufficiently complex patterns of behavior, correct?
Yes, I think that's right. Yeah, I think that, and as you say, the view is quite flattening in that respect. I mean, one way to put that would be to say, it thinks that I take the boundaries of the mental to be somewhat blurred, and that follows, I think, from the fact that I'm claiming that talk is metaphorical, so that the aptness of metaphors is a matter of degree. So for instance, in the case of a dog, for instance, in creature without language, if we think about the memory as a notebook example, if I say, well, the dog remembers where it lives, what am I saying? I'm saying that it makes sense to treat the dog as if it had an inner notebook with its address written down. Well, that metaphor is much less apt than it would be in the case of a person used language, because someone who's using a notebook with an address written down, if you ask them where they live, could tell you the address, could read it out. And that's not true of the dog's behavior. Nevertheless, there are some ways, some patterns in the dog's behavior, like where the dog will run back to if it's, you know, coming back from a walk or have you, that are well captured by my metaphor. So I'd say, well, these metaphors, although they're based on human practices of using language, of using representations like inscriptions in notebooks or what have you, still they can be apt to a certain degree in talking about other animals, for instance. That I think is true.
I mean, I could, you know, it's because there's a whole debate, you know, in the, you know, animal cognition or comparative cognition of, you know, do apes read minds, right? For example, is that they mind the deflationary view that, no, there's just behavior reading. And so you're saying, no, it's all behavior reading. There is no mind reading.
Yes, I suppose so. I should say I'm very aware that I'm not at all an expert animal cognition, so I'm aware that there are in sort of deep waters here that I need to be careful. But I suppose all the point that I would just be concerned to make is to say that that this is a view that I think allows for the possibility of minds without language applied to animals or pre-linguistic infants and so on. And the reason I want to emphasize that is just going back to what I said earlier, that I do think language is very important. I do think that our concept of mind, as I've said, is a kind of projection of our languages and our representations inwards. And it's quite natural to think that a view like that, which privileges language, is going to or might tend to rule out, say, animal cognition. And so I just want kind of emphasize that I don't think that conclusion follows at all. In fact, as you've said, I think it is a fairly flat view that sees attribution as happening broadly similar ways in all of those cases. Nevertheless, of course, that, you know, and there are important differences, and that leaves open a huge range of really important both empirical and conceptual questions about exactly what mental states we want to attribute to different sorts of animals based on their abilities and so on. And I certainly don't have a good handle on that at the moment. But I certainly do think Vue doesn't rule it out. And hopefully it makes the attributes accessible, because they're based on behavior.
Right. I mean, there's lots of interesting ways to pursue that. But let me get to the question of metaphor. Just my familiarity, such as it is with metaphor from, cognitive psychology, is, there's some sort of a mapping from one, base domain to a target domain. And there's supposed to be some sort of, at least on, Dedra Gentner's view, for example, there's similarity in the relationships between, components in the base and components in the target, and you can use a very flowery sort of metaphor like time is a river, or love is a journey, but also in more in science, you'll get certain models of like the atom as like a solar system. And so there's parts of the, we're familiar with the base domain, and we describe the target domain in ways that are, can be mapped to the elements and relationships of the base domain. That's one understanding of metaphor, which is not all of fiction, obviously. So could you say what your view of, when you say mind is metaphor and the view is called mental fictionalism, what precisely do you mean by that?
Yeah, so the idea, so as you say, that it seems to be, we accept that it's characteristic of metaphor, that there's a movement of terms from one domain that typically we think we understand better or is more accessible to us for some reason, to another domain that perhaps we lack ways of talking about, or is less accessible, have you. And exactly as you say, that those moves are familiar in the sciences as well as in all sorts of parts of everyday life. In the case of the mind, I want to say that the two domains are, as it were, the less well understood domain, the domain that we're interested in talking about, is people and the way that they behave in the first instance without using external tools. So without declaring what they're going to do when they're doing it, for instance, or without writing down some information, then looking it up and so on, just the people sort of walking around, without telling us very much about what they're up to. So that's the domain we're interested in trying to make sense. And the thought is that what we do when we invent this concept of mind is we try to make sense of that that kind of behavior in people by looking to this other enormously rich domain, which is also the movement of people and their behavior, but this time involving tools. So writing things down in piece of paper in a notebook and then looking it up later on, or saying out loud, I want a cup of coffee, and then going to make a cup of coffee. So the thought, the realization that motivates the invention of the concept of mind is that realization that we can treat people in the first instance when they don't have access to it, when we're not saying what they want to do out loud, when we're not writing things down and so on, we can nevertheless make sense of them by treating them as if they were writing things down, were saying things out loud. So then they have a desire for a cup of coffee, even when they just walk up to the cat and switch it on without saying, I want a cup of coffee, for instance, acting as if they have that. Representation helps us to explain why they're reaching in the cupboard and picking out the coffee jar and so on, in something like the way it would if they were to have told us out loud or what's going on. So that's the as you say, the characteristic feature of metaphor is those two domains, and I want to say both of those domains are taken from human behavior and culture. the reason I think this you know, this term fiction is quite unfortunate in a way. It's something that is something of a term of art in various areas. I've written about fiction in the context of scientific modeling, for instance, and of course it's always somewhat unfortunate to talk about a relationship between science and fiction. It can lead people to think you're a skeptic or a flat earther or what have you.
Right.
In this context, meant to mean that when we look as if we're making assertions about an inner world, we don't mean those assertions literally, just as we wouldn't if we said the clouds are angry, a friend was standing at a crossroads of their life or what have you, that we're engaged in a kind of a minimal form of pretense that's akin to what happens in fiction and children's games and so on. But nevertheless, we're doing it for a serious purpose. We say someone's standing at a crossroads, we're trying to make a genuine assertion about where they find themselves in their lives, faced with a difficult decision. And when we use this metaphor, this fiction of an inner world, what we're interested in when we're not doing philosophy or psychology, but in everyday life, we're interested in behavior, what they'll do, say, and so on.
Okay. And so that kind of brings up the question of intentionality, right? Because there's a whole, there's all kinds of, the whole explanations in cognitive science, how to naturalize representation. And, there's all sorts of research programs, I guess is the best way to put it, that go on, which if this is correct, would just be like completely off base. So I'm not going to go there so much, because it's a whole nother discussion. But I do want to get to the issue of intentionality. And you do say in the book that, the intentionality of mental states, such as it is, I suppose, which it certainly would, the whole meaning of intentionality would be completely different, but at least for mental representations, but that public, language, that's perfectly fine intentionality in the usual sense. So could you explain how your view relates to the intentionality, the meaning, the semantic content of language, and then how that how you explain that, or the so-called intentionality, I suppose, of mental states, as in some sense parasitic upon or derived from the so-called original intentionality in language, public language?
Yeah. So, I'll do my best. So, I think. As you say, that the view here is arguably in a minority. I take it the typical approach that you will find to thinking about intentionality proceeds in exactly the opposite direction. So the typical approach would be to think, why is it that sentences spoken out loud and disturbances in the air or marks on paper, why do they have content? They have content because someone, there was a speaker or a writer, and they had certain thoughts. And so usual view, take it the intentionality of public representation like language is dependent on the thoughts of those who are using it. And in the representationalist view, the way that content ultimately bottoms out is in the inner representations that writer, speaker, air, what have you. And as you say, in a way, I want to turn the direction of explanation the other way around. So now, I should say that I should just admit at the outset that I don't think that fictionalism in itself is a theory of meaning. So I don't think it gives a theory of public intentionality. It's not a theory of language. but it's still reliant on the idea that we could, as it were, acquire language without explaining its content in terms of prior inner state. So it's at least important for the fictionist to sketch one version of how that might go. So one view that it's not at all Newtonian, original to me at all, is would say, well, look, start from the fact that we're social creatures who tend to act alike much of the time and tend to discipline in various ways, from subtle to more to less subtle, those people who are out of line. So we have, in other words, communities in which norms arise, certain patterns of behaving that we're supposed to engage in. And one of the things that we do is use tools with all. So, if you think about something like a screwdriver, it's used in certain norm-governed activities, and that means that there's something that it's for. It has a certain function. It's for, driving the screws rather than making a hole in the wood or taking the lid off a paint parcel, what have you. And the broad idea that's common to many thinkers who have this kind of view would be that language is a tool in that way, that we start to utter sounds and make marks that have a particular role, that are for something, for labeling, for instance. And that really is, broadly speaking, how meaning arises. Now, as I say, it's a view that has found very different thinkers. There's certainly an awful lot that needs to be done has been done to sketch that out. I think where fictionism comes in is to say, well, look, once you have a community that has language, that has external representations, how would it get the concept of mind? And that, I think, comes, as it were, afterwards, when that external world of sentences, of the noises and marks with certain social roles, gets projected metabolically inside. So I think where the fictionalist story comes in, it's how in a community that already has developed language as a norm-governed social group, then come up with the concept of mind. But quite right to say that's, although there are lots of people who developed something about that view of languages, and perhaps did a more to present.
Okay. I do want to pursue that, but we're running low on time. So I do want to get back to one of the things you said at the very beginning on material culture. And we haven't really talked about material culture, although just now you're talking about, language as a tool. Can you, sort of to go back to that aspect of how you even, came to mental fictionalism, can you say a bit about the relationship of this to your background or original views on material culture?
Yes, it was perhaps quite like a lot of these roots. It's a little bit tortuous, but I'll try to. I think, as I say, the original interest for me was in thinking, look, if as philosophers we want to understand scientific knowledge, reasoning, what it can tell us about the world and so on, then we need to take into account what all these wonderfully rich historical and sociological stories have told us about the dependence of scientific reasoning on diagram systems, doing formulae or models, reach simulations or what have you, and the particular social institutions are created that are created, like the world society, or having to govern their end use. Originally, something that we haven't talked about very much, but many of the readers would be familiar with, of course, is that the extended mind thesis and similar ideas that are ways of trying to say that what's happening externally when someone, say, works through a formula on a piece of paper should count as reasoning. And so a few years ago, what I was trying to do was use some of those views, particularly extended mind thesis, to talk about scientific reasoning in that way. So to try to say that for example, the use of instruments could count as a kind of perception, and that's important for the way we think about empiricism, for instance, or that understanding in science is very often an extended state that involves interacting with formulae and diagrams and so on. But the extended mind thesis still accepts what we've been calling representationalism. So it still accepts the idea that perhaps even in all cases that we find in the real world, outside of philosophical thought experiments, mental states are in the head. It claims that under certain, perhaps slightly unusual circumstances, and they could extend that. And so I suppose the way I began thinking about mental fictionism was of trying to give a different view that could reject that idea of the mind as in a world, but nevertheless explain why it is that we're tempted by it. And the result is, as it were, almost the reverse of the extended mind thesis. So the extended mind thesis is a thesis that says, well, sometimes under special circumstances, the mind can spread out to material culture. I wanted to say that, well, in fact, the most foundational move, it seems to me, is exactly the opposite way around. It's that we develop material culture and then metaphorically project that inwards to create the concept of mind. I think what that means, if we think about something like the history of material culture and sciences, is that is a different way of thinking about epistemology. That if we think about Locke or Hume or those empiricists who wanted to talk about the limits of the human mind, the way that they do that is by thinking about the mind as an inner world of ideas and asking, well, what are its operations? What is its relationship to the world outside? And we get the central problem of lots of foundational problem of lots of Western philosophy to understand that relationship. And I think what I'm trying to say is that that the mind itself has a history, and that history is the history of the creation of different tools for thinking and the social environments in which they occur. And that by creating those tools, we don't have a, as it were, a fixed inner world that somebody like Hume is trying to describe. We have this sort of constantly developing world that allows us to think new thoughts.
Okay. Well, I think we are out of time now, unfortunately, because there's a lot of different avenues to pursue there. So tell us, you know, just to close, what are you working on now? Are you following this up, or have you turned to something else?
I'm following it up, or trying to. I think by addressing, follows from what I was just saying, by addressing the historical aspects of the question. So, you know, at the moment, what I've been trying to show is that it is part and parcel of our concept of mind as a folk psychology that we have today, that that we think of the mind as an inner world, that's a metaphor. And I'm interested now in asking, well, when did we get that conception? A lot of people that think the early modern period, quite understandably, is critical there, but where did we get that conception, that set of metaphors, and what purpose can they serve?
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for a very interesting conversation. I appreciate you taking, I appreciate taking the time to talk with us at New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you.
And good luck with your current projects as well.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.